Chapter 8, Eyeshadow Abs. October 1999. "Hello, New York," I yelled to the crowd, one of the biggest I'd ever sung for. It was at Madison Square Garden, opening for Ricky Martin on the North American leg of his world tour. I had already been learning so much watching Ricky perform and connect with his fans. There were 20,000 people coming night after night. His movements were so big, like he wanted the very last row to see him without the Jumbotron. That night, I was inspired by Ricky to really go for it, too. I went out there dancing and singing "I Think I'm in Love with You." It was a pop dance song with the John Mellencamp riff from Jack and Diane, but there were still big notes for me to hit. So, center stage at MSG, I went to nail the high note, crouching down in a squat so I could really deliver. My pants split, right in front of all those people. When I stood and walked, they started falling off me. I froze as the musicians tried to keep the song going, and then I just slowly walked backwards until I was backstage. I started crying, and my mom ran over to me, frantic. "What am I gonna do?" I said. My mom stood there a second, nodded her head, and kicked off her shoes. She stepped back and pulled off her jeans right there. "You're putting these on and getting back out there is what you're gonna do," she said. I put them on and she leaned back to get a good look. "Take my shoes," she said. "You need a higher heel with that jean." The absurdity of it came over me and I laughed as I marched out, literally in mom jeans. I smiled, a real genuine smile, as the crowd welcomed me, the girl who split her pants and got back up. "All right," I said into the mic. "I don't know who saw my booty, but I'm going to sing it off. So here's my next song." I got one of the biggest cheers of the tour. When people saw the real me, they wanted me to succeed. It was a fleeting thought, and I wish I had caught it and internalized it. I still thought people expected perfection. I certainly wasn't hearing otherwise from my label. After all, Tommy wanted those Janet Jackson abs. Columbia got me a trainer, one who made me run on the treadmill and sing my scales or my songs. It was helpful because I learned how to maintain my breath throughout an entire song while doing heavy-duty choreography. I just wasn't getting that cut stomach, but I will tell you a secret. I faked them. Right before a concert, I would draw a six-pack on myself with my eyeshadow pencil. I thought, "I'm on stage, it's dark, people will be like, oh wow, she's ripped." And then I saw any picture taken with a flash and I would be like, "Oh girl." I held the advanced CD of Sweet Kisses, turning it over and over to look at it fresh. "Remember this," I told myself, "remember this." I wanted to be still just for a moment and hold on to this feeling of happiness and pride. I'd gotten so hung up on superficial stuff, but the music was what mattered to me, and now it was going to be out in the world. Someone I would never meet in my life could press play and they would feel what was in my heart. How many times had I set aside my shyness because that need to connect was the only thing bigger than my fear? Columbia expected it to sell huge because my single had done so well. I did too. Though it would eventually go double platinum, that first week, it sold 65,000 copies, landing with a thud at number 65 on the Billboard chart. Many critics, mostly men, seemed to review who they thought I was rather than the actual work. I would get used to that, but it was a shock to me then. One called me an aspiring trophy wife, and another wrote I should leave because my mom was waiting for me in a station wagon. I still don't get that one. A convertible, maybe. But it was only the numbers that mattered to Columbia and Sony, and I didn't know how I could have done more to sell that album. I was barely able to keep up with myself with all that I was doing. Britney sold almost twice as much her first week, I reminded my dad, though I knew he knew the exact number. We were in another hotel room. I was now someone who knew enough about the industry that I could throw around numbers, but not so much that I knew how to get them. "But you're a better singer, baby," he said. "Then why won't God let me have that success?" I asked. "I don't understand what he wants from me." At the mention of God, my dad slipped into preacher mode. "He's allowing you to go through this struggle so that he can build a strong foundation in you," he said quietly. so that when it comes time for you to have that success, you will appreciate it and you will know how much work it takes. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be given to you, I said, finishing John 15:7 for him. You can take the girl out of the youth group, but you can't take the youth group out of the girl. That's a beautiful promise, isn't it? He said. Yes, I sighed. The verse did minister to me, though I also knew my dad didn't really think fulfillment resided solely in sticking to scripture. Otherwise, we'd still be in Richardson, and I wouldn't have to be working so hard to prove my worth. I started to hear voices when I was alone at night, waiting for the sleeping pill to kick in. Half asleep, I would examine myself for flaws in the mirror. A mental chorus would weigh in. They were intrusive and so mean that I was really convinced Satan was behind them. You're never going to be good enough, Jessica. Look who your competition is. Could your zits be any bigger? What happened to your hair? It used to be so much thicker and longer. Do more sit-ups, fat ass. These thoughts derailed me just as I had to work harder to sell the album. It should have been no different than back when I stood next to the stage at a small Texas rodeo selling my very first album. Back then, I knew if I just kept at it, people would respond. But now I was running on fumes, then beating myself up for that, too. I was fully aware that I was being unreasonable with myself. I would even beat myself up over beating myself up. But, like a lot of times in my life, just because I could name the problem didn't mean I was ready to do anything to fix it. Looking back, I see how my anxiety amplified the very real pressures on me, but I didn't have that perspective then. So I doubled my efforts with radio, and when my tour with Ricky Martin was done, I went back on tour with Nick and 98 Degrees again. By then, the girls knew what was happening with me and Nick. A lot of them were just blatant with their hatred, literally throwing garbage at me and saving their bras for Nick and the guys. I was working nonstop on the tour and promoting the album, but at a December tour stop in Madison, Wisconsin, my body again humbled me and told me I needed a break. I got a terrible kidney infection, and I spent 9 days recovering on the fourth floor of St. Mary's Hospital. Nick's tour with 98 Degrees had to continue without me, and only my mom stayed behind to hold my hand. We watched the snow fall and complained about the hospital food to fill the days. I had to cancel so many showcases and fan events, and I'm sure I cried on the phone to Charlie Walk about how bad I felt about letting everybody down. I don't know if it was him or Tommy, but someone arranged another call to make me feel better. A few days into my stay, I was alone in my hospital room watching Family Feud. This was comfort viewing from when I was a kid and loved game shows. The phone rang and I picked it up, assuming it was Nick or my mother who had gone out to run errands. "Hi, Jessica," said a chipper voice. I had learned that this kind of voice at the other end was usually an assistant, and no matter how cheery the girl sounded, it didn't necessarily mean the actual news was going to be good. "There's someone who would like to speak with you." I thought it was Tommy Mottola firing me. "Okay," I said, turning off the TV as I tried to sit up. Then this bright, beautiful voice came on, one I recognized immediately. "Jessica, it's Celine Dion." "Oh my gosh," I said, "I love you." "I hear you're not feeling well," she said in her French-Canadian accent, rushing her words. "I just wanted you to know how much I want to love you forever." That means so much to me. Celine started singing my song, "I Want to Love You Forever." She just nailed the line, full throttle out of nowhere, and I was laughing because I was so happy. "You just made my life," I said, meaning it. "Jessica, I am so excited for you," she said. "You have so much ahead of you, and I want you to remember one thing I have learned. The best competition is always our own selves." "Thank you," I said, crying. We hung up, and soon after, a nurse came in to check my vitals and saw my tears. "You okay, hon?" she asked. By then, I knew all the nurses on the floor. "Nanette, Celine Dion just called and sang to me." "Really?" Nanette said, casually checking my forehead for a fever that might be causing hallucinations. "The best competition is always our own selves," I thought. Who knows who Celine was told she had to be when she started out? And later, even with all her success, who she was told she had to be to stay at the top? I looked at the window and the snow falling. A red bird had perched itself on the ledge of my hospital window. "You see that?" I said. Nanette was on her way out and stopped to look. "Pretty guy," she said. "Don't you know to fly south for winter?" I said to the bird. "What are you doing in all of this cold?" "Nah, that's a cardinal," she said, leaving. "They're crazy enough to stick it out." Me too, I thought. Nick and I had a rule about never going more than 2 weeks without seeing each other, and generally the way we spent time together was through work. We helped host MTV's New Year's Eve party to welcome 2000 and even did the countdown in Times Square. The ball dropped to a blizzard of confetti and fireworks, and Nick kissed me at midnight. People ran a photo, which helped us break out of the teen market a bit. After that, when I went to events with 98 Degrees, photographers would ask the other guys to move to the side just so they could get a shot of Nick and me. We started getting hosting gigs, and Nick was a natural. He could talk to anybody, answering the same interview question for the 15th time that day and act like his answer was something that just occurred to him. I've always said that if he wasn't a singer, he should have been a politician because he was so personable. I was always fumbling, saying something I didn't realize was funny until everyone laughed. It was interesting to me that MTV kept inviting me back when they seemed so reluctant to play my actual music videos. I had to beg my fans to call in to Total Request Live to get my video played. God bless them, because they did. The label thought we could bump up my sales by releasing my duet with Nick, Where You Are, as my second single. I was happy because it meant that we would be together on the promotional tour and it wouldn't be just me on the dog and pony show. Around the release of the single, I did an interview with Teen People where they asked me about being a virgin. I said I wanted to wait until I got married. "I don't judge people who have sex before marriage," I said. "I'm not trying to make anyone think that I'm such a good girl or such a holy person. I'm a regular girl." I didn't realize this statement was going to get so much attention, but the magazine got the most letters it had ever received about a story. Young people, an awful lot of regular girls, talked about the pressure they were under to be sexual before they even really knew what sex was. I also didn't realize I'd just handed every daytime show a news hook for having us on. They asked Nick and me about my virginity at every appearance. And my take was that it wasn't so much about saving myself, but building up anticipation. I was 19 and still sheltered, so it was kind of bizarre to me that people felt free to ask, "How have you not had sex yet?" The interviewer would always start with me and then turn to Nick, who was 26 and a man. This situation did not compute for them. "And you're okay with this, Nick?" they'd ask. He always handled it well, since we both knew the question amounted to, "You're cool with dating a girl who doesn't put out?" "I really respect everything she cares about and everything that's important to her," he said on The View. And she talked about this from the very beginning, and so I knew going in that that was an issue for her, and that was cool with me. It gave America a storyline to follow. The sexy virgin and the long-suffering but still understanding hot prince. Barbie and Ken didn't have sex either, right? Nick loved the fact that I was so strong in my faith and that I had this wide-eyed, innocent approach to life. He didn't share it, though. I would get so frustrated asking God to take the blindfold from his eyes and help him find a spiritual center. And then I would hear Sarah telling me to relax and to just accept him for who he was. Our duet, Where You Are, sold okay numbers and didn't push the album higher on the charts. So Tommy Mottola was determined that I make good on showing my abs in the video for the next single. When discussing the concept for I Think I'm in Love with You, the label kept using the phrase MTV friendly, which meant big smiles and skin. We shot over 3 days at the Santa Monica Pier and it was freezing, but you would never know it. I wore a white blouse tied under my bust line, but where the ties of the shirt didn't cover, I made sure to keep feeling the music by placing my hands around my stomach. I was just so uncomfortable showing that much of my body and jumping around. "Nothing to see here, folks. Buy my album." I had been on the covers of a bunch of teen magazines, and then Nick and I started appearing on magazine covers together. Then we got the cover for the very first issue of Teen Vogue. It was a huge deal for us. Herb Rich shot the cover on the beach in Malibu, and when I heard about the location, I got scared that this was going to be another let's show some skin situation. Herb had shot Janet Jackson's Love Will Never Do Without You video, which introduced the world to the abs Tommy Mottola thought I should have too. I didn't need to worry because Herb immediately put me at ease. They didn't want me too done up, so there was very little makeup. He was so focused on the light of the sunset on our faces and capturing the real sweetness of two people who were genuinely crazy about each other. I wore J. Crew jeans and a baggy cream sweater from DKNY Jeans. Nick was in a Banana Republic sweater and Dockers khakis. Mall clothes people could see themselves in. I held the sleeves in my fist just like, well, a real girl on a date with her cute boyfriend. I swear it seemed like he only took 10 shots before announcing he had it. He was right. It was one of the first covers I didn't pick apart for a flaw. Condé Nast did a huge media push behind Teen Vogue, mailing their first ever issue to everyone who was subscribed to regular Vogue. This was incredible exposure for us and a chance to establish ourselves outside the teen market. The cover line was Pop's New Princess, and then Jessica Simpson in huge red. And then beneath, smaller and in black, and Nick too. I was so proud, but I also recognized that I had entered the relationship as Nick's plus one. Whenever I felt self-conscious about the increased attention I was getting from the media and how it might affect our relationship, I would tell myself, he sells more records. And he did. 98 Degrees had a single come out that June, Gimme Just One Night, Una Noche, which reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. You Were Only As Big As Your Last Hit, and he had just had his biggest one yet. I didn't want to outshine him because that just wasn't what I knew. He seemed so much older than me, my guide in everything. I wanted him to feel like he could show me all that he knew about the business, about the world. He was there for so many of my firsts, even my first taste of alcohol when we were in Hawaii. At 20, I had never had a drink before, and I turned to Nick like a father asking if it was okay. "You're on vacation," he said. I immediately felt the effect, and Nick thought it was hysterical. I realized I liked the woozy feeling. "If we get into the hot tub," Nick said, "you'll feel it more." "Oh," I said, "then let's go to the hot tub." I pinballed down the hallway talking to everybody we passed. After I told an elderly woman she was beautiful, I whispered to Nick, "Was that weird?" "No, just keep going," he said. He was right about the hot tub. We kissed and I stopped worrying about everything. "Okay, so what kind of drink can we have tomorrow?" I asked. He brought 2 wine coolers to my room at the hotel because, of course, we had separate rooms. These were the starter drinks the kids in my high school drank at the parties I avoided. I drank too, loving the feeling of calm it gave me, the closeness to Nick it gave me. I felt grown up, closer to his age. "Oh, it's pretty outside," I said, getting up to go to the balcony. I walked right into the screen door, knocking it off its hinge. It crashed to the ground, and I laughed because Nick laughed. He called down to the front desk to have it fixed, and I stood behind him when they sent someone up to fix it. "Relax, baby," he said, and I did, feeling like maybe I was growing up after all. We were all changing in my family, and in a real way, we were all growing up together. We were having experiences we would have shunned years before. I'm not sure when my parents started to drink alcohol, but they took to it. The lines are so blurred in the music industry. There's a need to be in the mix, and so many meetings and events are at bars and restaurants. They wanted to fit in. There were parts of us that were still so country, but we were all trying on these new lives. We didn't go to church, and I noticed my dad dropping F-bombs on the phone as he advocated for me. As we changed, my parents' marriage had devolved from a friendship to a business arrangement. They fought more than ever, always nitpicking and blaming each other if some plan with my career didn't work out. When Tom Hicks, who gave us the money to move to California, came to get a return on his investment, my dad didn't want to pay him. "It's pennies to him," he said over and over. "He's a gazillionaire." "Dad, you signed a contract," I said. "We signed a contract." I had to pay him a huge sum of money, and this was out of my income after taxes. He wasn't the last person I had to pay off because of a promise my dad made on my behalf. But I didn't ask questions. I just missed the days when we only had to save up to tithe. Sony and Columbia decided to make a push for me in the youth market. So during graduation season, I did Disney grad nights in Orlando with Destiny's Child. Disney World would shut down the park certain nights and only allow high school seniors to attend. We would perform at the end, and I just loved it. It gave me more time to bond with Beyoncé and Kelly Rowland. This was pre-Michelle. And besides having Teresa in common, these were Texas girls who hadn't forgotten where they came from. Beyoncé and I had similar family dynamics, so I think we understood each other well. Her father had left his business, in his case, Xerox, not Jesus, and her mother, Tina, became the group stylist. Our younger sisters, Ashley and Solange, were both our backup dancers, and they too became friends. We shared failure stories to buck each other up. Hers was Star Search back when the group was known as Girls Time. Mine was the Mickey Mouse Club disaster. Destiny's Child were just really nice people. And I was so used to being one of the only girls on a tour with guys that I loved being with them. It was also ironic that here we were, two singers who'd left school to be the family business and never had a graduation day, celebrating all these other kids who did. One of the grad nights, we were all backstage just before a concert when a security guard came up to me. "There's a girl who says her friend is a huge fan," he said, "and her dream is to meet you." "Tell her I will absolutely be hanging around after," I said. "Cool, cool," he said. He started to turn back and then added, "Just so you know, her friend is blind." "Go get her now," I said. He nodded, smiling. He brought back two girls. "This is Lauren," said the friend who led her to me. Lauren was 19, my age and wearing her school's baggy white class of 2000 t-shirt. "Hi, Lauren," I said, and I asked if I could hold her hands. She nodded, saying, "You sound like you." "Well, I hope so." "I've listened to your album like a million times," she said. "I know all the words." She told me she loved I Wanna Love You Forever, but her real favorite was Your Faith in Me. "I listen to it when I'm down," she said. "You sing from the heart, I can tell. Your Faith in Me is about going through something alone, but getting through it knowing someone who isn't even there believes in you." Her friend started to cry, I guess because she saw how happy Lauren was. It almost made me start, but I fought it because I didn't want Lauren to think I was sad about her situation. She was a beautiful, happy girl, and I was blessed to meet her. She cared about how I made her feel, not about what I looked like. "We all get down sometimes," I said. "Can't appreciate the ups without the downs. Life's like an elevator, I guess." I had this whole plan to bring her on stage to sing with me on I Wanna Love You Forever, but security wouldn't allow it. So instead, I promised to dedicate the song to her. "Now, when you hear me say your name, I want you to yell so I can see you, okay?" I said. "Don't leave me up there all on my lonesome." During the concert, she yelled her heart out, and I asked everyone to give her a cheer. "I don't normally do Your Faith in Me, but I don't want to disappoint you, Lauren," I said. "Thank you for reminding me why I do what I do. You can lose track sometimes. This song is for people like Lauren and any of you who feel connected to me through my music. If you feel it, I feel it too, and all of you inspire me to keep on keeping on." I did a few verses of the song a cappella, and I was touched that so many people in the audience knew it well enough to sing along. "Your faith in me, it pulls me through," we sang into the night air, when there's nothing around to hold on to. Around that time, I taped a Disney special with Nick, and looking back, I can see the beginning of the roles we would later play on our reality show. They filmed us at a beach in LA, walking with his arm around me. "This is where I like to take Jessica on all our hot dates," he said. I'm a real big spender. $3 to park. A wave came in and almost got our feet, so I screamed. We were just goofy and fun. They set up a thing where some tween girls were sitting with me on the beach having girl talk. I remember this little cutie with a sweet face straight up asked me, "Do you think that less guys come to your concerts and stuff because they know you have a boyfriend?" I was taken a little aback by such a marketing-focused question from a kid. Who taught you to think that way, I wondered. Sony? That's a good question, I said, stalling. I don't think that every guy is coming to my concert because they think they can be my boyfriend. I think they come because they like to watch the show and they want to have a lot of fun, you know? Tommy Mottola disagreed. I had to look like somebody the boys wanted to be with. In a word, hotter. In July, we started to work on my next album, and Tommy wanted to go all in on making me a combo of Britney and Mariah. He said he would be even more involved this time, and I needed to be doing more dance pop over the ballads I loved. I also had to get even skinnier. I started the Atkins diet hardcore, envying and resenting anybody who could just eat. Off the diet, I obsessed over how I looked 24/7. On the diet, I was also hyper-focused on food. It made me nervous. My anxiety had something to hold on to, and instead of examining my emotions, I could just block them out by focusing on carb counts and waist sizes. If I focused on controlling my outward appearance, I could avoid thinking about my emotions and fears. My mother sometimes, with the best of intentions, fed into it. Her aerobics teacher past would kick in, seeing a problem to fix and giving a solution she thought would help. When she urged me to exercise or told me she was going for a long walk and maybe I should come along, I knew what she meant. We ended up doing the Atkins diet together. I was still out there promoting the first album, and in so many interviews, I ended up talking about food and my diet. I had no filter and would say whatever was on my mind or slipped out of my mouth. Whether it was about my strict diet or how irritating it was to be constantly compared to Britney and Christina. The marketing department thought it was too much of a peek behind the curtain on what it was really like to be a pop star. The label finally decided I needed media training after I did an interview with the CBS Early Show at the Arthur Ashe Kids Day, a concert that kicks off the U.S. Open every year in August. I have to admit, I did not know who Arthur Ashe was. Now I know he was one of the greatest tennis players in the world and the first African-American man to win Wimbledon. When he came out as HIV positive in 1992, he created an impact that lasted long beyond his death a year later. But back then, I just showed up and sang where people told me to. 98 Degrees was going to perform, so I was excited to sing with Nick again. I barely knew who any of the tennis players were, even Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi. During the interview before the concert, the tennis players and us singers stood off stage, and we were each asked what it meant to be there to celebrate Arthur Ashe's impact. "I'm just so proud to be here and to give back," I said, and then turned to Andre Agassi. "This is such a great event you put on." Andre's eyes widened in a look of, "I don't know what you're talking about." Everyone, including the news crews, realized I thought Andre was Arthur Ashe. The late Arthur Ashe. That was the last straw for Columbia. They made me do media training. It was awful. Imagine My Fair Lady, where they fire questions at you, completely random ones. I had to learn how to manipulate the conversation back to music, the reason you're doing 45 interviews a day in the first place. It felt false to me, but I couldn't deny that I would lose the thread on every interview and spill my guts. An innocent question from a teen mag about Christmas plans would lead to me talking about my family missing Sarah and how we were all still grieving, so the holidays were hard on us. Merry Christmas, kids! Or a journalist would point out that Britney and Christina seemed to be struggling with fame. And I would just take that bait and say I thought Britney was the nicest girl, but maybe Christina didn't need to have her security clear an entire hallway of staff and talent just so she could walk through it alone. I was too honest to play the game. As you know, media training never really worked on me. Thank God. Part of it was that I was just so sheltered. I was trying everything to get on MTV, a channel that was forbidden to me as a kid. Then as I grew up, I kept my head down working so I didn't understand the most basic things about pop culture. I grew closer to Casey Cobb, the woman in Teresa's office who'd always hounded me about my homework for my GED. Our relationship was mostly on the phone. She also had to keep calling to track us down because we'd once again moved into another staged home or because Teresa needed to send potential tracks to wherever we'd landed. I was one to procrastinate, and Casey's "you have to" was non-negotiable. Still, when she called, I would always find reasons to have small talk with her, stalling whatever task she was going to give me. "What did you do this weekend?" I asked her. "I had some friends over to watch Sex and the City," Casey said. "What's that?" "Sex and the City? Is that like a dirty movie?" I asked. "Jessica, it's a huge show. You've never heard of it?"
"No."
"Okay, we need to fix that," she said. She said it was crazy that I was supposed to be making music and trying to be a star, and I didn't even know about the show that was landing with the very same people I was trying to reach. Casey sent me tapes so I could catch up, and I devoured every episode. "Oh my God, I love it," I told Casey. "I'm totally a Carrie." She laughed. "Okay, Charlotte."